Today is Thursday, December 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Trump administration expanded pressure on China.
The U.S. banned cotton from one of China's largest cotton producers on Wednesday.
Plus, a new report shows that wages plunged in the first half of 2020.
Despite the bleak picture, ILO Director General Guy Ryder says there's some positive news.
And have you ever wanted to be Mario? We'll have these stories and more next. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a law to delist Chinese companies if they do not fully comply with U.S. auditing rules, giving U.S. President Donald Trump one more tool to use against Beijing before he leaves office. Reuters' Gloria So is up first.
The U.S. House has passed a law to put Chinese companies under closer scrutiny and could see them delisted if they don't follow tighter rules. The bill gives President Donald Trump another tool to threaten Beijing with as he approaches his final weeks in office, and clearing the House makes it almost certain it will become law. It would bar any foreign companies from listing on a U.S. exchange if they fail to disclose ties to foreign governments. But the legislation is intended to target Chinese companies such as Alibaba, tech firm Pinduoduo, and oil giant PetroChina. The Chinese embassy in Washington did not immediately respond to a request for comment. However, before the vote, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying called it a discriminatory policy that politically oppresses Chinese firms. Measures taking a harder line on Chinese business and trade practices generally pass Congress with large margins. Both Democrats and Trump's fellow Republicans echo the president's hard line against Beijing. Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen, a co-author of the bill, said in a statement that American investors, quote, have been cheated out of their money after investing in seemingly legitimate Chinese companies that are not held to the same standards as other publicly listed companies. The Holding Foreign Companies Accountable Act is now headed to Trump, who is likely to sign it into law.
Reuters reporter Libby Hogan picks things up from here and reports that the Trump administration expanded economic pressure on China's Xinjiang province.
The U.S. banned cotton from one of China's largest cotton producers on Wednesday. A ban will be slapped on both cotton and cotton products from the Xinjiang Production and Construction Corps. The XPCC is a quasi-military organization that the U.S. says uses forced labor of detained Uyghur Muslims. The move is in line with the Trump administration's hardening approach to China and increased pressure on China's western region of Xinjiang, just weeks before President-elect Joe Biden is due to take office. It's expected to lock Biden into a position, making it harder for him to ease U.S.-China tensions. Homeland Security Secretary Kenneth Cuccinelli said the Made in China stamp should serve as a warning label, adding that, quote, the cheap cotton goods you may be buying for family and friends during the season of giving, if coming from China, may have been made by slave labor in some of the most egregious human rights violations existing today. The UN estimates that there are about 1 million Muslims being held in camps in Xinjiang, but China says the camps are vocational training centers needed to fight extremism. Major brands, including Gap, Patagonia, and Zara, who have spoken to Reuters, say they did not source from factories in Xinjiang, but couldn't confirm that their supply chains were free of cotton picked from the northwestern province. The U.S. Border Agency also said a region-wide Xinjiang cotton import ban was still being studied. U.S. apparel and textile makers have criticized a broader ban, saying it's impossible to enforce. But on Wednesday, clothing and retail groups welcomed the XPCC-specific ban. The business and paramilitary entity accounted for 30% of all of the cotton produced in China in 2015.
Libby Hogan and Gloria So report for Reuters News. U.S. President Donald Trump, in what he called maybe his most important speech he's ever made, has rolled out a litany of already disproved baseless accusations concerning the election he lost last month. AP correspondent Tim McGuire has more on the video posted on social media Wednesday night.
In the online speech, President Trump again falsely claimed some sort of conspiracy stole the election from him and gave it to President-elect Joe Biden.
I am determined to protect our election system, which is now under coordinated assault and siege.
In another misstatement, Trump claimed the votes were rigged during the mail-in balloting.
We used to have what was called Election Day. Now we have election days, weeks and months, and lots of bad things happened during this ridiculous period of time.
Trump has lost dozens of court challenges, and members of his own administration, including Attorney General William Barr, have refuted his allegations. Tim McGuire, Washington.
President Trump has also threatened to veto a major defense spending and policy bill unless it includes eliminating a law protecting internet companies from liability for material posted by its users. U.S. Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany spoke to reporters on Wednesday at the White House.
President is serious about it. And I noted, when you have other world leaders that are making calls for genocide and Twitter not finding that worthy of flagging or blocking. Beyond that, you look at China, who's putting out disinformation. China tweeted out, I believe it was 6 days ago, I think it was November 25th, that COVID-19 did not originate in Wuhan, something that was not deemed worthy of flagging by Twitter. There are real grave concerns here, and the president stands by that. And it also is worth noting that the president will always defend our military, ensure that we get adequate defense funding, as he's gotten $2.9 trillion so far. But he is going to put the pressure on Congress to step up on this.
I spoke to VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson to get more details.
So Section 230 is something that Republicans have been raising concerns about all throughout this year, particularly since it's been an election year. They have alleged that some of the large social media companies like Twitter and Facebook have discriminated against conservative viewpoints, and they've said that they've been censored on those social media platforms. They've even pulled in the CEOs of those companies to try and get some answers on that issue. And they've talked a lot about this Section 230, which many people may know is known as the law that built the internet, that allows free discourse online without those social media companies being held liable for the content that's posted on their platforms. Now, where we get into a little bit of trouble is the fact that the president is connecting these two issues. When you talk to a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill, they're saying that this issue should not be connected to the National Defense Authorization because this is such an important issue of national security.
Now, Catherine, both the House and the Senate have passed resolutions to fund the military. They're trying to iron out the differences before it is sent up to the White House to be signed into law. And provisions to change Section 230 is not in that bill. So what would happen if the president follows through on his alleged threat to veto it?
Well, the first thing that would happen is that the military wouldn't receive its funding for the year until they could sort out some sort of deal with the president. Now, remember that the NDAA is so popular on such a bipartisan basis that it almost always passes with a veto-proof majority, meaning that it would then get kicked back to the U.S. Congress and they would be able to override the president's veto. So it's a little bit of a confusing moment here because ultimately the president is not going to be able to get what he's saying he wants to get.
Now, Catherine, one last question while I have you on the phone. What are you hearing from those walking the halls of Capitol Hill about funding the government? Because currently, the spending authorization to keep the lights on, so to speak, of the U.S. federal government is only going to last a short while longer. What are they saying about the prospects of signing a new deal?
You know, we go through this pile up of legislative items every December. Every year at the end of the year, the things that the U.S. government needs to get funded and that need to be done that Congress should have been working on for the past couple of months all suddenly get jammed into these last few days in session when lawmakers want to fly back to their home districts, take that holiday break, take a breather before the new Congress starts. and they just leave everything for the last possible moment, in part because everything that's debated politically in the United States these days is so politically partisan, and nobody wants to be the person who makes a deal or gives in. So instead, they wait until the absolute last deadline. And what I'm hearing is that they're really hoping that they can get something done, but it's not a sure thing. And that means that they're going to have to pass a continuing resolution, which is basically legislation that temporarily funds the government and then kicks this whole discussion into the new year so that they can go through it all over again.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. First daughter and White House advisor Ivanka Trump has been deposed in a case against her father's 2017 inauguration committee. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has more.
A court filing reveals Ivanka Trump was deposed this week by lawyers with the Washington, D.C. Attorney General's office, which is suing the Trump 2017 inaugural committee for allegedly making more than $1 million in improper payments from the nonprofit fund to the Trump family's hotel blocks from the White House. The district's attorney general alleges Trump's inaugural committee spent more than $1 million to book a ballroom as part of a, quote, scheme to grossly overpay for party space and enrich the president's own family in the process. The Trump Organization says Ivanka Trump was involved in connecting the committee with the hotel and making sure it was charged a fair market rate. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
And coming up later,
here we go!
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
From ostriches and emus to kiwis and penguins, scientists say that there are currently about 60 living flightless bird species in the world. There are many more species, like the giant moa, that became extinct over the years. A new study published in the journal Science Advances suggests that the number of flightless bird species would be quadrupled today if it weren't for human interference. The study, led by researchers from the University College of London, also proposes that flightlessness evolved more frequently in birds than was thought if extinct species along with current species were considered. To make their findings, the researchers put together a list of 581 bird species that have gone extinct from when our earliest human ancestors walked the earth until today. Of the 581 extinct birds, 166 of them weren't able to fly. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. More than 100 world leaders and high-ranking government officials will convene a two-day virtual special session of the United Nations General Assembly on Thursday to discuss the global response to the COVID-19 pandemic and to craft a recovery strategy. The Associated Press says Friday's second and final day will include three virtual panels: the global body's response to the pandemic, the current progress toward a coronavirus vaccine, and the global economic recovery from the pandemic. Thursday's meeting comes as the world nears 1.5 million deaths worldwide from COVID-19 out of a total of 64.5 million cases. Among the latest to succumb from the disease is former French President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, who died on Wednesday at his home in central France at the age of 94. Giscard was diagnosed with the novel coronavirus in September. In the United States, which leads the world with more than 13.9 million COVID-19 cases and more than 273,000 deaths, the situation is worsening each passing day. On Wednesday, the nation topped 100,000 hospitalizations for the virus for the first time since the pandemic began, according to the COVID Tracking Project, and nearly 200,000 new cases. The AP's Sagar Magani takes it from here.
Biden had already warned of a dark winter ahead yesterday.
We're likely to lose another 250,000 people dead between now and January.
His forecast is far bleaker than projections from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, though Director Robert Redfield painted his own dark picture yesterday of the next few months in a U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation webcast.
They're going to be the most difficult time in the public health history of this nation.
The CDC is urging Americans to skip holiday travel or get tested before and after if they do venture out. The CDC's Dr. Henry Walk says something has to change.
Cases are rising. Hospitalizations are increasing. Deaths are increasing.
And one way to bend the curve is to skip holiday travel. The CDC asked Americans to do that over Thanksgiving, but many ignored the advice. This time, the CDC is adding another option. If you travel, get tested before and after. The new guidance comes amid a dire warning from Walk's boss, CDC Chief Robert Redfield, who tells a U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation webcast the months ahead will be the most difficult in American public health history.
December and January and February are going to be rough times.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Lisa Schlein reports the International Labor Organization says wages plunged during the first 6 months of the year due to the COVID-19 pandemic, with women and lower paid workers among the biggest losers. Its report is based on data from 30 major economies in Africa, the Americas, Asia, and Europe.
A survey of 28 European countries finds that without wage subsidies, women would have lost 8.1% of their wages in the second quarter of this year, compared to 5.4% for men. The data indicates 50% of those in lower-skilled jobs would have lost more than 17% of their wages without subsidies. The International Labor Organization says the unequal impact of the pandemic on wage earners in wealthy societies is relevant to developing countries where workers in the formal sectors have been particularly hard hit. Despite the bleak picture, ILO Director General Guy Ryder says there's some positive news.
We estimate that the wage subsidies which have been introduced in many countries have compensated for 40% of the total wage bill loss. And because wage subsidies are more likely to benefit low-paid workers, it is also likely that these policies have helped to mitigate the upward trend in inequality.
ILO economists warn the COVID-19 crisis is likely to greatly increase poverty and inequality. World Bank figures indicate the number of people falling into extreme poverty because of the pandemic could be between 88 and 115 million. Ryder notes 90% of the ILO's 187 member states have some form of minimum wage. That, he says, can serve to lessen the impact of the pandemic on workers.
Next, our report suggests that adequate minimum wages have significant potential to reduce both inequality and poverty. Our studies show that they could reduce household income inequality by as much as 10% at the national level. In addition, minimum wages can also play an important role in creating a recovery that is human-centered.
ILO Chief Ryder notes the pandemic has rendered an unprecedented blow to the world at work. He says he expects the aftermath will be long-lasting, turbulent, and full of uncertainty. He says government subsidies and interventions will be reduced over time, putting downward pressure on wages. He says there must be an appropriate and balanced approach to wages in the recovery process to stop a resurgence of poverty and prevent a further widening of existing inequality. And last but not least, to keep the economy moving. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hong Kong media tycoon and pro-democracy advocate Jimmy Lai has been arrested and charged with fraud. The 73-year-old Lai appeared in a Hong Kong courtroom Thursday along with two other executives of his Next Digital company and was accused of violating terms of the company's lease of its office space. He was denied bail and his case has been adjourned until next April. Lai was previously arrested in August and charged with suspicion of colluding with a foreign country under the city's new national security law imposed by China. France plans to start investigating mosques suspected of fomenting Islamist ideology to combat the rising threat of religious extremism. Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said the government was launching what it calls an unprecedented action against separatism following several Islamist attacks in France this autumn, including the beheading of a teacher who had shown his class caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. 76 mosques out of the more than 2,600 Muslim places of worship have been flagged as possible threats to France's republican values and its security. Where suspicions are confirmed, the mosque will be closed down. Azerbaijan's defense ministry said Thursday that 2,783 of its soldiers were killed during its conflict with ethnic Armenian forces over the enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh, and that more than 100 of its troops were still missing. AFP is also reporting that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will visit the country on December 9th. Armenia said Wednesday that it had dropped some of the martial law restrictions it imposed in September when fighting erupted. Art therapy can be part of working through past trauma. Maxim Moskakov tells a story of sexual assault survivors who have turned therapy into a thriving business that also helps other women survivors.
Cousins Ellie Clogerty and Kristen Malinowski grew up in Northern Virginia and both headed to Virginia Tech to get a degree in neurobiology. The young women had a lot in common. One of the big things, both say they are survivors of campus sexual assault. As part of their recovery, the two launched a jewelry line called Camaria.
When I started designing jewelry, I went from an idea of something that wasn't in existence yet, and you could just find a way to bring it to life.
The young women started studying jewelry making in New York and traveled the world to learn different jewelry styles. A year after Camaria was launched, Clogerty and Malinowski started a nonprofit called Restore Dignity that offers financial help to the victims of campus sexual assault. 10% of Camaria's proceeds go to the Restore Dignity.
You would be surprised to know that we have had applications from students who are having their diplomas held until they pay their student health care costs, and those student health care costs were directly attributed to sexual assault.
Many jewelry pieces that Clogerty and Malinowski make are asymmetrical. The cousins say they are meant to show beauty in imperfection.
It's so meaningful, and it's easy to attach symbology to something so small.
One of our signature pieces is the butterfly necklace, and the butterfly represents hope and transformation, which is a good reminder for survivors.
The young women believe the COVID pandemic has taught people to be more empathetic towards each other. They say these times are forcing many people to lead very isolated lives, like the ones sexual assault victims often lead.
Camaria means moonlight in Swahili, so the idea is, like the moon, even when you're surrounded by darkness, you reflect light just because you exist.
We're going to support
Maxim Moskalko for VOA News, Washington.
Universal Studios Japan in Osaka said it will open its new Nintendo-themed area on February 4th of 2021 after pushing back the opening from the summer due to the coronavirus outbreak. Reuters' Maha Al-Badrawi brings us the story.
Here we go!
If you've ever wanted to immerse yourself in the world of Mario, Yoshi, and Princess Peach, you're in luck. The Nintendo theme park in Osaka is finally set to open on February 4, according to Universal Studios Japan. The area will feature Mario Kart races, attractions based on Nintendo games, as well as restaurants and gift shops. Executive producer at Universal Creative, Thomas Garrity, also revealed details on augmented reality features.
Guests boarding the ride will wear this augmented reality headset created by Universal's ATI group internally to meet the needs of the attraction. And this will immerse the guests in the world of Nintendo, where they ride right alongside of Mario, Peach, and Bowser.
Super Nintendo World was originally set to open in time for the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games, but like the Olympics and many other events, was delayed earlier this year.
That was Reuters reporter Maha Al-Badrawi. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day by visiting our website. Just point your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.